morning, everybody. Matt Bobal here with you on 720 WGN. Thanks for staying up even later tonight. Jess Rains is producing, and Roger Treemstra.
Oh, and the weather forecast for today. We've got this cold front coming down from Canada.
Roger Badish is upstairs on the seventh floor in the
newsroom. That's right, as long as you call me for dinner.
How you doing, bud?
I'm doing all right. I had a long night tonight in Chicago. Downtown.
You've had a long night?
Yeah, I got down here about 5:30.
Why so early?
Had a reunion of colleagues from Edelman Public Relations.
Oh, my goodness.
And we met over at a bar not too far from here. And so I got over there about 6 and stayed till about 7:30, came over here, kept David Jennings company.
You didn't take a little nappy nap?
No. No, I probably should have. You know, it's old people.
So be listening in the 5 a.m. hour for the news for Rogers. Yeah. You're going to be a mess by
then. I'll be fine. I've done this before.
I'm an old pro. I've been doing this for years.
I did 48 hours straight one time.
On air? Was this a telephone?
Covering a story and filed a report every hour to Associated Press for 48 hours straight.
Was this in Vegas?
Yep.
What was the story? Did you have a fire?
No, it was a hostage siege in a jail down in the Las Vegas jail. 3 prisoners beat up a couple of guards and took their guns and held them hostage for 48 hours. And then other prisoners fought their fellow prisoners and finally overpowered them. And it ended.
Jeez.
As like 30 reporters started running up a parking lot. All the ramps up about 4 flights with all of our equipment, trying to get to the door, the entrance of the jail where they were coming out. So, yeah, that was fun. That was right when we were getting ready to move back to Chicago, and I was trying to figure out where the moving truck was.
While you were reporting this story?
Yeah, I'm checking with my wife. And our child was not even a year old. Sarah was not even a year old at the time. So I left my wife at home with this baby with boxes all around the place and trying to figure out where our moving van was that was coming in from another state. I think we went through 3 moving vans before we got one that wasn't broken down, wasn't lost, or something else. And when it finally came and picked stuff up, so... But yeah, that was I was taking little cat naps as we were waiting for negotiations and stuff, but still having to file stories with Associated Press. I was the lead for quite a long time.
Is that the biggest? You know, you've had a lifetime in the news, and is there a story that when you think about everything that you've been a part of or covered in your life that you think of as being the big thing? 312-981-7200, if you remember, interesting, you know, I think what people remember about certain moments in life, about certain places they were when things happened. Mm-hmm. What's the story when you look back on everything you've created or just experienced in life that you think about?
Probably that, just because of the length of it. Working at Q101 when I got back to Chicago, finally... and covering the Pope's visit. Was back in,
81, right?
I want to say 81,
yeah.
80, 81.
I think so.
Standing on top of a building at the corner of, Milwaukee and, I forgot the other street. But as the Pope's caravan came through that intersection, and just report, I talked the owner of the shoe store into letting me go up onto the roof at the corner there. And I covered that. And then running back downtown to cover another part of that day or that night.
Did you do Mass in Grant Park, or was it a Comiskey Park?
It was in Grant Park.
In Grant Park.
And I covered that too. And I will be forever known by other members of the media as the idiot kid sitting in the corner of the press bus, doing latch hook to while away the time.
Oh my God.
I was doing a latch hook for our kid.
I haven't done a latch hook in like 40 years.
I think it was Fozzie Bear.
Sad that I can say that I did something 40 years ago.
There
though.
You go.
That's a problem.
So I think it was
Fozzie Bear.
A Fozzie Bear.
I remember doing one of Big Bird as a child.
Yeah, we had Fozzie Bear, and I forgot what the other one was, and I actually framed them. Hung it up in Sarah's room for quite a number of years.
I believe my mom made a pillow out of my Big Bird latch hook.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, it's nice.
Small little throw pillow.
So I did that, and covering the mob in Vegas.
Okay.
Was a big thing, because if you remember the movie Casino.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's true events, and the guys that ended up in the cornfield mm-hmm. in Indiana, right?
That's right. And I covered several murders, bodies that were found out in the desert. We found one underneath a boulder.
They didn't do a very good job, huh? They just said, throw this rock
in front
of
it. They just got tired. Fine. You know, it's just,
you know, in the movies, they're digging these big ditches. They're very careful, but in real life, they're just behind a boulder.
Yeah,
it'll be fine.
You know.
It's a big desert. Who's going to find
throwing them off buildings and throwing them out of windows. We had a couple of those. But I did cover a trial of one of the Spilotro brothers out in Vegas.
And that's...
I think he got... obviously, he got... released, yeah.
But those are the two brothers that ended up in...
Mm-hmm. They found in Indiana. So, yeah, covering the mob out there, which is probably the ones who slashed my tires.
Yeah.
I remember telling you about that.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, the Pope here. And then I'll tell you another exciting day was about almost 11 years ago, right after I started working here, because I had been out of broadcast, out of being on the air... I was always connected with broadcasting, but being on the air for almost 30 years. And I came back, and one Friday night, I came in, and Judy Pilak was on the air.
Okay.
And as I walked in, she said, this was about maybe 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, she said, there's a fire on Lakeshore Drive, on the inner drive, at this place, I forgot what the address was. Here are the keys to the news car, news van. Here's a recorder. Go cover it. And I was supposed to go on the air. I was supposed to anchor after her about like an hour after I got there. But she said, go cover this. I'll cover your shift. I go, okay, fine. So I go driving over. It was cold out. It was kind of wet. It wasn't a nice night weather-wise. And I'm driving over, and I hadn't done this now for 30 years. And I drive up to where the police car is blocking the road. Now, again, I couldn't see exactly where the fire trucks were. And I yelled out, I'm with WGN Radio. And he gave me a very, whatever, go ahead. And I drove up, I ran across a field, and the fire was out already.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got there, and they had already held the press briefing, I've got nobody to talk to except the residents who are now walking back in. So I interviewed a couple of them, and I filed a live report with Judy on the news. And as I'm driving back home, or driving back to the station on Lakeshore Drive, I call my wife, and like a kid who just got the gold ticket in Willy Wonka, I was screaming to my wife about how excited I was. I was beside myself with joy. And I was psyched, to say the least. And I think, unfortunately, the recorder was still recording. And when I got back, Judy says, I'll go ahead and cut up the audio for you. You go ahead and go on the air. And goodness knows what she might have heard. But, yeah, that was a very exciting moment for me to be on WGN, to have gone, covered a story, and filed a report live. And,
all those years away from broadcasting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. 312-981-7200, Matt Bubala here with you. Coming up after the news, Michael Greenberg, a photographer who recently spent time in Cuba, will talk to us about the island and what it's like and what they just went through a little bit with the hurricane. So I was listening, I think, to one of your reports on the way in, Rod. So you said there's a new hurricane forming possibly in the Pacific, right?
Well, there's one going to Mexico, yeah.
We know that Jose is still in the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's Norma is the one heading to Mexico.
Irma and Norma in the same year.
Yeah.
That seems like they're going with a retro something.
Well, but it's female, male, female, male.
I know, but Irma and Norma.
Yeah.
When's the last time you ran into a Norma? I had an
my dad's second wife. Is
okay,
Norma.
Yeah, and my uncle was married to a Norma.
Okay,
who I never met.
Oh, okay.
And there was Norma on Twin Peaks, of course, but I don't know any Normas in everyday life, and it seems like a name that
it's an older name
that's lost favor.
Yeah,
Irma. I do know Irma upstairs. Who? No, I don't know an Irma. Do I know an Irma? I don't know an Irma. I'm thinking of Bertha. I don't know an Irma. These seem like names that, you know.
Well, you know, they've gone through, like, the more popular names over the decades.
But they only retire major storms. They can be used again. And there's millions of names.
Well, yeah. Want to make them memorable. Look at you. You're talking about Norma.
I guess.
You know?
You think somebody at the National Weather Service is like, you know, you don't hear people name people Norma anymore.
Yeah,
let's use Norma.
Maybe
let's,
that's what they're
let's
doing.
Bring back Norma. But yeah. That doesn't seem like it's going to increase the popularity of a name. Because if it's a really destructive hurricane, I don't think there's a lot of Katrina suddenly walking around. I don't think after 1992 everybody said, you know, let's name the kid Andrew.
Well, and as you're saying this, I'm thinking, well, maybe people there who were caught up in the storm, maybe their next child might be named after the storm
really?
As a remembrance of, look at what we survived.
I guess if you got through it, but if there was a lot of devastation, people lost their homes, you'd think they meet your kid named Andrew. They're like, bad association.
Well, yeah, you know? I guess. Yeah.
All right, we'll chat with Michael Greenberg about Cuba after the news. We got to catch up on some breaks and then get the headlines from Raj next on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for hanging out late. We're live in the Allstate Showcase studio in the historic Tribune Tower. Mike Greenberg is a photographer from New York City who spent a lot of time in Cuba recently. There was a great story and photo spread on tablethotels.com. Has really cool pictures he took in Cuba, and also he was there for the hurricane recently. We're going to chat with him about Cuba a little bit here in 1 second. 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you this early Saturday morning. Thanks for staying up with us. Mike Greenberg joins us on the phone right now. He's a photographer in New York City who spent a lot of time in Cuba recently. You're not in Cuba right now, right, Mike?
Oh, no. I'm in New York right now.
Thanks for jumping on the phone with us. We appreciate you staying up late. Although it's New York City, so people never sleep anyway, so you're probably up at this hour normally, right?
Yeah. I mean, I am one of those people who kind of stays up late.
Bit nocturnal.
Late. Yeah.
So I want to talk about Cuba quite a bit. I'm also very interested in just the idea of being a photographer for a living and how cool that must be, how much hard work that must be. And how uncertain at times it must be. But let's jump into Cuba first, because I saw the spread that you did that Tablet Hotels put out at tablethotels.com. And I saw it because I think they were really pushing it as Irma was bearing down. And it's funny, Mike, I don't know where you were when Irma was hitting, if you were in Cuba. But here I was amazed. I was saying this earlier to Roger that as the storm was coming, I heard about Barbuda, which I'll embarrassingly admit, I had never heard of Barbuda in my life. It sounds like the way my dad would mispronounce some other country or something. And then we heard about a lot of other, and then like there was no real mention of Cuba. And I was thinking, boy, you know, we just reopened, kind of traveled to Cuba and stuff like that. I couldn't believe we were getting absolutely no love for Cuba and what they were facing. But you've spent time in Cuba, and were you actually in Cuba during Irma?
No, I wasn't. I was in New York, but to your point, I think we don't hear a lot of news about Cuba in general in the States. It's kind of one of those like non-points that kind of gets skipped over almost in every hurricane that passes over the Caribbean.
There's no, yeah, well, and I guess a part of that must be the relationship we've had, and maybe there aren't really news outlets there or, you know, I'm sure the Weather Channel must not have people there or else we would have been seeing them all the time. Maybe it's just not. I just wonder sometimes, is this sort of our we're ignoring you, or is it just we just don't have things set up properly to talk much? But even when they were talking about where it's going, there just wasn't a lot of talk about Cuba. So how recently were you in Cuba and how much time did you spend there?
I was there for about a week in May. One of my friends kind of hinted at go now before restrictions start clamping down further on traveling to Cuba.
And we have heard that that is going to, you know, go backwards again. It hasn't really yet, though, right? I mean, it's still relatively easy for an American to go to Cuba.
I would think so. I mean, it was remarkably easy when I went, and I'm not sure it was really changed all that much. I mean, as long as you have family or have some sort of educational purpose of going, I think you're pretty much in the clear.
So how did you find Cuba to be? I mean, most American tourists, I'm going to generalize here really badly, are not true travelers. My guess is you're a traveler. You get out and you really see a country. Most of us go to Mexico to a resort where we sit on the beach and really don't get much culture or much education or get off the property much. For an American tourist, as far as you could see, would you say, you know, it's not going to be that experience of going to Cancun, folks. It's going to be a little more real. I imagine we don't have a bunch of American-style resorts down there at the moment.
Yeah, you're pretty much inundated the second you get there. It's probably the most visually overwhelming cities and countries I've been to, especially Old Havana and Havana in general. I was completely unprepared.
Why was it so visually stunning? What stands out? Old architecture? Is it a bit of a time warp? Do you feel like you've gone back to a previous era?
Yeah. I mean, but within that architecture, it's aged, and there's no other way of explaining it other than things start crumbling, and you're seeing like modern clothing and people kind of lifestyle against these old buildings that are don't really have the same kind of upkeep as we have or have not been restored, and it's beautiful. There's no other way of explaining it other than overwhelming.
So it's beautiful. It's overwhelming. Is it also sad? I mean, do you feel like this is incredible because I don't see it, but also this is, you know, you said crumbling. Do you fear that, you know, when you're walking around there, do you feel like, wow, this is all going to be lost at some point because they're not able to upkeep it? They clearly are not, either don't have the money or don't spend the money on the infrastructure.
There is a lot of construction going on, especially on the roads and the streets, to kind of bring it kind of up a little bit. And there are little areas that are getting built up with these high-end kind of strips. Like I saw something like a Versace. And knowing that the income is not there for locals to be buying Versace. Yeah. It's obviously for the coming tourists. And I think that's the part that I found a little bit more jarring, where it was like, okay, here's this city that's getting ready for this tourist boom.
Yeah. Were there hotels and things being built that you could see that, wow, I can see that the laws have changed and they're preparing for an influx of tourists that they weren't getting before?
Not yet.
No.
Not yet. It's not like when you go to like Cancun or Acapulco and there's always something being built.
And I wonder if now plans for any of that are on hold with the current administration and the thought that, you know, they might scale back the ability again for Americans to travel there.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure about that.
Sure.
I mean, I have a feeling there's always going to be some sort of like cruise ship coming through.
Yeah. What were the people like in Cuba and in Havana? Were they friendly to you as an American? What do they feel like?
Very friendly to me as an American, especially so as a New Yorker. Lots of Yankees fans.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, a lot of baseball players, they come over from Cuba, yeah. So that. And when you travel to Cuba, besides the amazing visuals, is there anything that stands out as part of the culture or as an American being in another country that is different than when you travel to the other countries you go to?
I mean, the given, I think, with Cuba is the, like, classic American cars are kind of everywhere. And kind of as a kid with a dad who is really into old cars, going around and seeing all these cars and seeing the culture of how, essentially, if you own one of these cars, you've learned how to take it apart and put it back together again on the fly. And people are just out on the street painting their cars, taking them apart, fixing them. And I found that to be really kind of beautiful to know that there's still that going on.
I'm looking at the photos now at tablethotels.com. And I do notice that it is a classic car in just about every photo. Are those as prevalent on the streets as we always hear about and think about, or did you have to search them out a little bit?
Oh, no, you can't miss them. They're everywhere.
Are there also newer cars, or is it just it's a time warp? The cars are from the 50s, 60s, and then that's it?
There are definitely newer cars. There's some Toyotas going around. There's Renaults. It's kind of whatever you can get, you get.
Yeah. And what is the, you know, of the people you met, what are most of them doing for a living? What is the, you know, are a lot of people unemployed, or does it seem like there is an economy that's working down there?
Without going too far into it, there is an economy that's, I guess, working. A lot of people were saying that the most money you can make is $40 a month. So it is a stifled economy. And people aren't really unemployed. I think it's just a different kind of pace.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people kind of working in restaurants, kind of in normal city and country life of kind of getting by, you know.
Sure. As a photographer, tell me a little bit about what that's like. I know you travel a decent amount. How do you decide where you want to go, or do you just travel and then find pictures where you find them?
There's a few different ways I go about it. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, I really want to see this. So it's like I'm trying to plan to go to India because I love what we in America call Indian food, and I want to know what it's really like.
Right.
So there's a certain authenticity involved in my seeking out of things where I'm just like, I want to know what this is actually like. I've heard a lot about Cuba. I want to know what it's like. Or I want to know about, next month I'm going to Myanmar. So I want to know what Myanmar is like. I hear a lot about what's going on in the north. I want to know how it's kind of affecting life elsewhere.
With that travel, do you decide you want to go to Myanmar and then you're going to take pictures and then shop them for an assignment when you get back? You know, the business of being a photographer, I imagine that unless you're working for a magazine or somebody who's going to pay you regularly, and I imagine those jobs are harder and harder to get these days. So you're really an entrepreneur, I would guess, and you've got to get assignments, find assignments. So is Myanmar somebody saying, hey, we want to do a piece on Myanmar, and you're like, hey, I'd love to do that? Or are you going to go there, find amazing photos, and then figure out who's best to shop these two when you get back?
It kind of sort of came up as a drunken accident.
The best jobs always are, Mike.
Yeah. I was talking to my friend, who's actually a publisher from Chicago, JC, and he was he wanted to talk to me about putting out a book of some of the stuff that I did in Africa. And I was like, that's really cool. I like the photos I shot in Africa, but I'm kind of over that. And there's not really like a narrative thread, but I really want to go to Myanmar. So we talked for another like 5-10 minutes about Myanmar, and much to my wife's surprise, who was also at the table, was just like, oh great, it just turned into a book about Myanmar. And it was kind of just one of those things where it's sort of a pitch, and kind of also kind of when you have relationships with people who kind of trust what you do, you can kind of go out and do what you like to do and what you love doing.
Is it tough to make a living as a photographer these days? Would your life have been easier had you been born in the 40s?
I don't know. I go back and forth. I've been really lucky in my career. I started in the late 90s when it was all film, and I shot with a 4x5 camera with a sheet over my head for a lot of my career.
Uh-huh.
Since the internet came around, there's a lot more accessibility to work in different cities. And so if you're kind of savvy to that, it's not too hard to get work, but it's a saturated market.
Yeah.
Like, especially with Instagram and everything, everybody has an iPhone or a camera, and people want to be photographers. It's a great job. You take pictures for a living. It's a dream.
I imagine, especially for breaking news photographers, say it's more difficult, because I see so often in working here in the media that we're requesting now somebody who is on the scene, can we use this photo? And you know, it's often somebody who just happened to be there who has their iPhone, which actually takes, you know, a pretty decent quality photo. It's not with the eye and the sense of style that a true photographer would have, but it gets the job done. And in today's media age, I think the standards have certainly been lowered.
I mean, I'm never one to knock the iPhone, just because I feel like the iPhone at this point is the point and shoot of this day and age. It's still a camera. It's what you do with it.
Yeah.
And I think for breaking news, I think the sense of urgency is also necessary with, like, makes the iPhone kind of necessary, especially in like instances like Charlottesville or something like that, where like so much is going on so quickly, and you can't really get to a laptop to upload photos.
True, but the famous photo from Charlottesville is the one that is instantaneous with the crash that, you know, and it was taken by an actual newspaper photographer. And my guess is your standard Joe on the street with an iPhone who gets it out real quick is not going to get that photo. I mean, wouldn't you say that there certainly is, I know you're going to, of course, say, yes, photographers are necessary, because they are. And you're right. Yeah, the iPhone's great, but that moment to me is never captured in that way, and with that immediacy and with the depth that it had if it wasn't for a true newspaper photographer being on the scene.
Absolutely. I mean, nothing is going to replace like a real camera in the hands of someone who knows how to use it.
Yeah. Michael Greenberg spent time in Cuba. He does fascinating work. You can see on his website, michael-greenberg.com. And Mike Tablet Hotels has the Cuba photos. Anything else we should be looking for on the internet? Great places to find your work?
My Instagram is at mgreenbergphoto, and my website is michael-greenberg.com. And there's more of my travels and celebrity work in that.
So Myanmar is the next big one?
Yep. All right. Going for about three and a half weeks. Yeah.
And does Mrs. Greenberg go with you on these?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, she does. Okay.
Cuba was her idea.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's good. As long as you can keep Mrs. Greenberg happy, you can keep traveling and working, is my guess, right?
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Well, have a good trip, and hopefully we'll talk to you when you return.
Thank you so much. All great talking to you, Matt.
You bet, Mike. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone. Again, michael-greenberg.com to see the photos and follow him on Instagram at mgreenbergphoto. News coming up, 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. David Koechner is going to get on the phone here in just a second. We'll chat with him about his show tonight at the Metropolis in Arlington Heights, metropolisarts.com for tickets. I'm very excited to ask him about Twin Peaks, and hopefully he's got some good stories for that. But that's not all that I want to talk to him about. Of course, he's had a pretty incredible career. Of course, an anchorman. He was on Saturday Night Live for a bit. We'll ask him about, you know, the struggles of a comedian or an actor as they go through. He was older before he really hit it big, and he still works very hard. In fact, we're going to be chatting with him from a comedy club out in L.A. We'll do that next, 720 WGN. 720 WGN, Matt Bubala here with you, joining us on the phone, David Koechner. He's in town tonight in Arlington Heights. David Koechner, Symphony of Chaos at the Metropolis at 7:30 p.m. Still a couple of tickets available. Go to metropolisarts.com and get to say hi to David Koechner. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm great. How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. Thank you very much. I have to ask you right away, how many times a day, I imagine not much when you're in L.A., but when you travel around the country working, how many times a day does somebody ask you to say whammy?
I'm disappointed if it doesn't happen at least three.
The over-under is three. And so you still look at it as, hey, that's a trademark. People love it, and they recognize me, and that means that that was very successful, and so I'm cool with that. It hasn't gotten to the point.
It's a blessing, of course. Absolutely.
Well, you know how some people are, that you want to get past that one thing, and constantly, I've done a lot of other work.
I mean, you know, if you get one, you're so blessed. If you get two, you know, twice blessed, three, you're a miracle.
Well, David, you so we're talking, of course, about Champ Kind from Anchorman and the second Anchorman movie and some shorts and different things. You've played Champ Kind a number of times. And you are such a I've been going over your bio and your IMDb page. Dude, you work like crazy. You never stop working. We're talking from a comedy club right now. After you've had so much success that you could be a guy that kind of takes it easy and relaxes on things, but you're always out there working. Is that just a mindset, or is it that actors or comedians fear of, you never know when this is going to end?
I have no fear. It will never end for me. I know I'm going to be working till I don't want to anymore. I assume I'm going to work into my 80s. But I have five children, so it's part necessity. I've worked since I was 7 years old. I worked for my dad when I was seven. He had a manufacturing plant where he manufactured livestock trailers for turkeys. And so, you know, all I've known my life is work, and I'm fine with it.
And I imagine when you're doing something you really love, then it's not really work, right?
No, it is play. You know, they call it a play. They call it a screenplay. It's a teleplay, and your job is to play.
What could be more fun than that? Okay, so you mentioned growing
right?
up. You mentioned growing up in work, and you grew up in Tipton, Missouri, which is about 2 hours outside of KC and about 3 hours outside of St. Louis. So does that mean you have to make a decision as a youth, or how does that work out? Which side do you go with?
I had cousins in Kansas City, so I was always a Chiefs and Royals fan.
So that was decided early.
That was it, yep. That was done and done. I remember watching the Chiefs in the longest game in history against the Miami Dolphins on Christmas Day. And I think that's when I got indoctrinated.
And the Chiefs are off to a good start. That was quite a game.
We're going to be off to a good start, a strong middle, and a stronger finish.
Really? Is this the year?
Yeah, I think it might be.
Wow, okay. And you go back to KC. You do a huge event there for a children's hospital every year, right?
Yeah, we do a thing called Big Slick. It's hosted by Rob Riggle, Paul Rudd, Jason Sudeikis, Eric Stonestreet, and myself. We raise money for Children's Mercy Hospital for cancer research. And this last year, we raised $1.7 million. Man. We bring in about 20 of our celebrity buddies and gals for a softball game at Kauffman Stadium, and then we do a big bowling tournament, and then we go visit the kids, and then we have a huge fundraiser that Saturday night, and we've made a difference, which is nice. And they've let us know. They told us specifically this year where our money goes to and what happens. And they had a major breakthrough, and I wish I could had the language to quote it what it was exactly, but they had a major cancer, pediatric cancer breakthrough this year. And it feels really good to have, you know, participated in something you know you're making a difference.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. As I mentioned, your IMDb page goes on and on and on and on. You've been in a ton of movies, a ton of TV, done a lot of like animated voiceover. Is there a favorite type of work when it comes to TV or movies or voices?
Well, you know, there's something great about all of them. You know, I love live performance. There's nothing like it. You're in communion with the audience. TV is the next most immediate thing. Film is the patient run. But in film, you get probably more freedom to collaborate than any other thing, except for your own personal stand-up. And there's something always special and magical about film. But it's so that, you know, you get a little more excited, I guess, about a film.
Well, speaking of film, I have to ask you about Twin Peaks, because that's a blending of film and television. David Lynch just brought back the iconic TV show from the 90s. And you had a pretty integral role in a number of episodes. Had you ever worked with Lynch before? Did you have any idea what you were getting into there?
No, I had no idea. And when I auditioned, it was just an interview with the casting director, and you didn't even know what project you're meeting for. And then a week or two later, they said, oh, you just got cast in Twin Peaks, but you can't tell anybody until they announce it. So, yeah, I had already shot everything by the time it got announced, and people were like, congratulations. And I'm like, oh, no, that was a half a year ago.
Yeah, it was famously secret the whole time with that. When they're doing the press release, the press tours for it, they weren't saying anything about the show. And we heard that nobody got the script except for Kyle MacLachlan. Did you have much idea of what in the world you were shooting there except for what your little scenes were?
No idea. In fact, I didn't know what role I had. I was told I was going to be a detective, and I got the pages the night before I was supposed to work, and there were two detectives, so I didn't know which one I was going to be. And then I showed up to work the next day, and there were three detectives. I'm like, what's going on? And so then we met with David, and he said, okay, you're Fusco brothers. You figure out who's one, two, and three, and great, I'll see you after lunch. And it was just such a unique and magical experience. It was awesome.
That sounds like it could either be really awesome or incredibly frustrating. Was there a little...
Oh, no, I mean, you knew that it was going to be special, and you're just happy to be there.
Had you ever watched Twin Peaks when it first was out? You were probably in your mid-20s when the show first came
out. Yeah, I saw some of it, but, you know, this is before, DVR.
Yeah.
And so if you didn't have, you know, a VCR... And, you know, you were ready to set it, then you're going to miss it. So I didn't see all of it.
And what about now? So you taped that stuff almost 2 years ago, right?
It was a year ago. It was in the spring, early. It was January and February of 2016.
Okay, so about a year and a half ago, and it finally airs.
Yeah.
Answer me honestly, David. Did you watch it? Did you get into it? Because this, and I love Twin Peaks. But, man, I could see where a lot of people are like, what in the world are we watching here?
Well, I'll be honest. Like, my wife and I have five kids. I can't watch anything. We don't have time. By the time we get to bed, we're like, oh, thank goodness, the day's over. All right. Is everybody in bed?
Yeah.
Is everything picked up? Did someone start the dishwasher? Are the dogs in the trash? let's go to sleep.
So is that how most of your work is? Like, unless it's a movie and you get out on the weekend, you just don't get much of a chance to really see it? Or do you not even like to watch it after you do it?
That's the truth. I don't get to see it. I get to hear about it.
Well, I'll tell you were really good in it, David. It was you and
the
Fusco brothers were really good comic relief, and it's that it's not just straight comedy; it's just the quirkiness of David Lynch, and however he gets it out of you guys, it was really good. So
good.
Kudos to you, sir. Superior Donuts on CBS comes back Monday, October 30th. It's set in Chicago. I know you guys don't film it out here. What can we expect in season two of the show?
I tell you, this show is only getting stronger. We've got such a wonderful talented, dynamic cast. I love them all personally. They are such a joy to work with. It's like we're putting a play on every week. The writers have hit an amazing stride. We're back in production. We're shooting number four next week. I tell you, it's feeling really special. And I know that sounds like BS, but I'm just telling you from an actor's perspective, they've really found their groove, and I'm so excited about this season.
As somebody who works so much, David, on various TV shows and movies and all the time, is there ever a project you're dying to be a part of, or are you always just looking forward to the next project? Because you're not somebody who's tied into one thing. You're always working on different stuff, it seems like.
It's a little bit of both, and you get excited when stuff's very special. I feel Superior Donuts is special. You know, I did, obviously, like you said, Twin Peaks. I did Bill Burr's animated television show called F is for Family. That is a kick in the pants. It's so funny, I can barely get through my lines when we have to do the voiceover. So, you know, I'm happy anytime something seems to be a cut above.
Yeah. Are you getting choosier now that you've been around enough and you've got so much under your belt? Are you at a point where you can say, you know what, that doesn't seem like my type of thing? Or
if you look at my resume, you can tell I rarely turn things down. Again, but it's economics, man. Five kids, college is not cheap.
It is not cheap. I know. I've got four that are headed there eventually myself. So.
Oh, you get it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Trust me. Absolutely. All right. So then, in all honesty, David, as a good Midwestern guy who's very honest, what's the one thing looking back over your 166 credits, according to IMDb, is there one that you look back and I go, yeah, that was, I don't know what I was doing on that one.
Yeah, there's two. I always knew what I was doing, but there's a reason for it, and I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell you privately one day. Folks can look through it, and they can decide which ones that are the two most embarrassing.
Well, that's a great, you know, maybe you could incorporate that into part of the stage show. So let's go through the IMDb, the wheel of IMDb, and if you pick the ones that I really regret, I will give you a steak dinner.
Then I'll give you $5.
There you go.
I will tell you something. It's going to be a special show on Saturday because Into the Woods is going to start next week, you know, the musical.
Yeah.
And they've already built the sets. They'll be on the stage. So this show, though it's called Symphony of Chaos, I might call the show David Koechner, Go Get Some Wood, because I'm going to have to incorporate the set into my show, and I'm going to try to do three songs from Into the Woods, but I'll have to make up the lyrics.
So this will be an exclusive show for Arlington Heights tonight.
It will never happen again.
Yeah, yeah.
This show will never happen again.
As somebody who works as much as you do, you don't need to go out and do stand-up comedy. You don't need to fly to Chicago for a night to do a show. Does it keep you sharp? Does it help you find new things? Why do it?
Yeah. Yeah, always. You look forward to it. It's a fun, I don't want to say challenge, it's a joy, you know?
Yeah. When I look at your resume and look at, so 95, 96, you're on SNL, and then, and you constantly work after that, but Anchorman doesn't come till almost a decade later. What is it like as a working actor, as a younger working actor, but you were in your 30s, you had SNL, but it's not like you became, you know, one of the huge stars from that. So is there ever a time in your life where mom and dad are calling like, you know, the family business is still going, son. If it's not working out, you can come back. Or are you like,
no,
it's no, there.
I made my decision. I made my decision when I decided to start.
Uh-huh.
And that was it. I never had any doubts.
I imagine that's the key for performers, isn't it? You can't ever say if this doesn't work out.
It's like you burn the bridge behind you and go, that's it, climb that mountain. This is all that's going to happen.
Is there anything you're looking forward to over the year ahead? Is there a special project coming up?
Well, like that. I hope to be doing Superior Donuts for the next 9 months, and then hopefully we'll have a nice big fat movie in the summer. Don't know what it is yet, but in my mind, it's coming.
Are you trying to be more in control of that now? Are you producing more? Or do you want to be a director? Everybody wants to direct, David.
Oh, no, I have no desire to direct. That's a different mindset. That's not me.
Yeah.
But I am producing more. I mean, I've got four projects we're trying to push forward. You never know what's going to hit. Maybe nothing hits, but, you know, you've always got to be developing stuff.
Is there anything people coming to the Metropolis to see you tonight should expect? Should they be prepared for anything? Should they have questions ready? What happens?
Maybe danger, whatever gets the most excited.
Be prepared, David Koechner, be prepared for danger. It's called Symphony of Chaos. It's at the Metropolis tonight at 7:30 p.m. Still a couple of tickets available. Go to metropolisarts.com and catch David Koechner live and in person.
Let's make magic, folks.
Anything special you'll be eating when you're in Chicago? I know in Kansas City, you know, you got a lot of great food in Kansas City. You spent time at Second City in Chicago.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'll be out in Arlington Heights, so I don't know the restaurants. My buddy Tony Petrillo is the president of Arlington Racetrack, and he's going to take me out to dinner, so we'll see. I'm sure we're going to get a nice fat steak.
I imagine you will. David Koechner at the Metropolis tonight, metropolisarts.com for tickets. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone.
Thank you, sir.
Star Rockets in Flight.
Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Thanks for staying up late, everybody. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You're welcome to call or text at any time. Tom Rivers from ABC News will join us after the 4 o'clock news. Chat a little bit about the latest in London and the terror attack over there. News that came out on Friday was that Harry Dean Stanton passed away at the age of 91. From Variety magazine, Harry Dean Stanton, the actor with a gaunt, bedraggled look who labored in virtual obscurity for decades until a series of roles increased his visibility, including his breakthrough in Wim Wenders' Paris, Texas, died of natural causes Friday in L.A. He was 91. Also known for his roles, he recently was on Twin Peaks, The Return. He was also in the Twin Peaks movie back in 1992. He was in the HBO series Big Love. Of course, I was first introduced to him as a youth when he was the father to Molly Ringwald in Pretty in Pink. He was in Repo Man, which was out also when I was young, but I never saw Repo Man. The Emilio and Charlie Sheen, I think, were both in that movie, right? I think that was their first movie together. Yep. He was in that. And his most recent film, what I believe will be his last film, although I could be wrong about that, called Lucky, about an atheist who comes to terms with his own mortality, set to be released on September 29th. Mm. Raj, in this story, they talk a little bit about, you know, just his career and things like that. Paris, Texas was written by Sam Shepard, who was the darling of the Cannes Film Festival, capturing not only the Palme d'Or, but other jury awards as well. Stanton played Travis, who reconnects with his brother, played by Dean Stockwell, after being lost for 4 years. Stanton's performance in the film was not so much powerful as it was intriguingly, sometimes hauntingly absent. Roger Ebert said, Stanton has long inhabited the dark corners of American noir with his lean face and hungry eyes, and here he creates a sad poetry. Have you seen Paris, Texas? You're my go-to guy here on the older...
Yeah, no, I have not, I'll be honest with you.
Okay.
No, in fact, my first exposure to Harry Dean Stanton was in Kelly's Heroes.
You love that Kelly's Heroes.
Yes, I do. He played one of the ragtag, I think just about everyone in the movie was playing a ragtag soldier. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a major role. He was just one of the several soldiers that made the trip to, get the gold. And, it wasn't a memorable performance, but that was my first exposure to the actor, Harry Dean Stanton. And then I'm sure I saw him in other roles. Like you say, he wasn't a leading man.
No, but he was in a lot.
He was a great character actor.
Yeah,
in so many movies.
He had a small role in Godfather 2.
Mm-hmm. Cool Hand Luke he was in. A small role. Again, you know, we're dealing with prisoners.
Right.
So he was one of the prisoners. What else was he in?
In The Green Mile.
Mm-hmm.
He was in David Lynch's Inland Empire, which not a lot of people have seen. I hear that's one of the toughest films to sit through.
Yeah, Alien. I do remember him from Alien. Escape from New York?
He was
Escape
from New York. He was the guy that kind of kept the machines running.
Yeah.
For the prison that Manhattan became. So here's what I want to ask you about, because I'm guessing you've seen this, a film called The Missouri Breaks.
Mm-hmm. Long time ago. I saw it once in the theater, and it was okay.
Well, here's the interesting thing about that. I read an article about that because in Variety, and they don't give more information on this, and it's driving me crazy because I can't find any. It says, on the shoot for 1976's The Missouri Breaks, mm-hmm. starring Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson, Stanton made a long-term friend in Brando when he courageously dissuaded the increasingly eccentric actor from making a foolish choice in his performance. And then they move on, and they don't give us the details on what exactly happened there. And so during your news, I'm scrambling to try to find what advice Harry Dean Stanton gave to Marlon Brando, and I can't find it. I did find an interview where he talks about, you know, how he became friends with Brando on that movie. I think Brando has to kill him in that movie, and and he was telling a story about how Brando was dressed as a woman at the time, and he tore the clothes, and the director's like, "What are you doing?" And he explained his choice or whatever, but I don't know what the advice was he gave him. And so I found a little blog piece about The Missouri Breaks that was written about 5 years ago, and the guy who wrote it said that this is an accidental masterpiece, that it was a failure. It was such a, he wrote, "How is it possible that the 1976 movie The Missouri Breaks was such a critical and commercial failure that most people have never seen or heard of it? Mm-hmm. After all, rarely has a more talent been assembled on a single project than for this movie. Stars Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson, both of them coming off Oscar-winning performances. And the two of them, fast friends in real life, were appearing together on screen for the first and only time. In addition, the cast includes Randy Quaid, Harry Dean Stanton, and Frederick Forrest. The score is composed by John Williams. And novelist Thomas McGuane wrote the screenplay with help from Robert Towne." So a bunch of big names, and then it's a big failure. Why? And you yourself said, where did that movie go wrong?
At the time when I saw it, it just wasn't... It wasn't a traditional Western as a kid growing up as, you know, used to a Western.
Right.
You know, cowboys, Indians, whatever, you know, save the damsel in distress, you know, that kind of stuff. This was a little on edge. It delved into deeper character traits that you don't really associate with a cowboy movie.
Yeah.
It kind of left me, what I just did, scratched my head. I wasn't too sure what I was watching, and when I came out, it just didn't sit well with me. And so it's not a film that I've wanted to go back to re-explore. Maybe I would see it in a different light now that I'm much older. You know, this is 1976.
I'm definitely interested in seeing this now. The blogger writes, "What's even more inscrutable is the fact that the film, viewed some 30 years later, holds up as brilliantly acted and gorgeously directed movie. Penn himself, Arthur Penn, was the director, and he was coming off of Bonnie and Clyde, Little Big Man, and Night Moves.
And Night Moves was another kind of strange one out there.
Penn himself is somewhat confounded by the lack of regard for The Missouri Breaks. He says, "I like that film a lot. Indeed, in some ways, the film is quintessential Penn. The outlaws are more humane than the ostensibly law-abiding establishment figures who are violent and cruel. The actors are given free rein to explore their roles and improvise characterizations and dialogue. The camera is used quite self-consciously in voyeuristic scenes with sudden shifts of focus. And of course, the film contains imaginative scenes of graphic violence. I said we have to find as many ignominious ways of shooting someone as we can find," recalls Penn. And indeed they did, including having people gunned down while involved in the most primal biological pursuits. Mm. So that sounds like an interesting and extremely very different movie.
Yeah.
Why is Marlon Brando dressed as a woman? Are they going in disguise? Are they on the lam?
Not sure. I'm looking at the plot here on the Missouri Breaks Wikipedia page.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Logan is a rustler experiencing hard times. He and his gang, particularly upset by the hanging of a friend by Braxton, a land baron, takes the law in his own hands. Logan's men pull off a daring train robbery, only to lose much of the money. They decide to seek vengeance against Braxton by killing his foreman, Pete Markram, by buying a small property close to his ranch, then rustling his stock. First, the gang, without Logan, rides off across the Missouri River, north of the border, steal horses belonging to the Northwest Mounted Police. In their absence, Logan plants crops and enters into a relationship with Braxton's virginal daughter, Jane. Braxton, obsessed with both his wrestling problem and his daughter, he sends Robert E. Lee Clayton, a notorious regulator, that's in quotes, who for the price will take care of rustlers personally. Clayton arrives with a fancy wardrobe, a perfumed scent, an Irish brogue, and a Creedmoor rifle, with which he is deadly accurate from a very long distance. That sounds strange. Whew. Wow. Clayton is, let's see here, Clayton is Marlon Brando. He's the killer in a very stylish way, so to say.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's
Well, that might be unusual. One I need to check out on Netflix or something sometime soon. I'll have to see if that's
interesting.
Out there. But I am really interested in seeing this film. Lucky, I'd seen the trailers for it in over the last couple of months. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they're popping up in my news feed, maybe because I'm a Twin Peaks fan and the Facebook algorithms know that, so they're pushing a Harry Dean Stanton film towards me. But it looks really good and really interesting. There's also a movie, I think it came out already this summer. It just came and went and nobody knew about it. With Sam Elliott, is it Sam Elliott, the beef, it's what's for dinner guy? He's a voice actor who you hear all the time.
Well, he's done a lot of TV and movies.
He's done a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
I most famously remember him from Point Break with... I'm sorry.
The first one?
Not Point Break. Different Patrick Swayze movie, Roadhouse Blues. Patrick Swayze is a bouncer at a roadhouse.
Oh, that's right.
And Sam Elliott's like the old bouncer.
Yeah.
He's teaching him the ways.
Yeah.
And he had a movie out, and I don't remember what it was called, but it's about an aging actor who had starred in a Western, and that was his whole career and what he's remembered for, although he's still trying to work, and then he meets a younger woman, and that just really looked such a good... It's
so hard.
Is that
the one where he's got the big bushy mustache?
When does Sam Elliott not have a big bushy mustache? Well, I wouldn't recognize him if he didn't have a big bushy mustache. That's part of his face. That's not a mustache.
I know.
That's not negotiable. That's Sam Elliott.
That's true. Not the Shadow Riders. Quick and the Dead.
I think it was maybe called Miracle or
Tombstone.
Something.
Tombstone. I'm looking at the...
I want to say the title of the film is the title of whatever the movie was that he's remembered for.
Ghost Rider?
It just came out this year.
Oh, this year?
It's brand new. It was like out this summer.
The Hero?
The Hero, probably.
Is that the one you were thinking of?
It'd say 2017 on it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. That looks really good, too.
Yeah, The Hero, he played Lee Hayden.
Okay.
In the character.
Somebody just texted, the movie is Hero.
A Star is Born is being redone for next year?
Yes,
with him?
Lady Gaga. Wait, what?
With him?
What am I thinking of?
He's in the movie.
Yeah, but who's starring in A Star is Born? It's Lady Gaga, right?
Lady
Gaga and Bradley Cooper, I think.
Bradley Cooper, Sam Elliott as Bobby, the benevolent manager. Andrew Dice Clay, Dave Chappelle.
In A Star is Born?
Yes.
And Lady Gaga, right?
Well, is her name Stephanie Germanotta?
Yes.
Then that's Lady Gaga.
Yes.
She's going by her regular name in this.
She just had to cancel a concert in Brazil. She suffers from fibromyalgia and severe pain. So she just had to cancel a show in Brazil.
It's amazing she does what she does with that disease. Seriously.
Yeah.
Because Bridget was first diagnosed with that, and it turned out to be rheumatoid arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not something I could learn to live with.
Mm.
Just every minute of every day, your body is being attacked.
Texter from the 815 said the movie is Hero and it's awesome. So somebody saw it and they loved it. So I want to see that too.
Good.
We
got to start our own movie club. When do we have time?
Yeah, when are we doing that? The 4 a.m. movie club? The Insomniacs movie club.
Wow, that would be cool.
That would be kind of cool.
Yeah,
we could do that. Although you'd make us see all these westerns we haven't seen.
Well, come
Kelly's
on, have
Heroes
you seen any of the John Wayne ones yet?
Kelly's Heroes clearly would be the first film on your list, right?
Oh, it would have to be. Yeah. It's hilarious. Hilarious. You haven't seen it yet. You didn't bother looking for it.
I
didn't look for any John Wayne movies,
no,
did
I haven't.
You?
No. Rod, you gotta understand what I go through. Mrs. Bubala has to approve anything that I, and if I say, hey, honey, we're gonna watch a John Wayne movie tonight, the eye roll I will be met with.
Really?
Yes. Yeesh. You know how those diplomats in Cuba have that hearing loss from the sonic boom or whatever happened to them?
Oh, right, right, yeah.
The eye roll would cause such a tremor in the house. That.
Jeez. She doesn't like Westerns?
You got to be in the right mood for a Western if you're not a big Western fan. I don't see her suddenly
going. She would love, there's a couple of John Wayne ones where it'll bring a tear to her eyes.
I don't know if that's what she's looking for.
Well, what is she like?
Either suspense and intrigue or comedy. You know, she loves She loves the old John Grisham movies like The Rainmaker. Cruise one with...
Where's the lawyer?
Well, I think it's a lawyer. In John Grisham movies, it's all lawyer. Describing a Twilight Zone. You know the one where they're confused about who is what and then it turns out in the end? Yeah, that one. What's the one where it's with Tom Cruise? I think he was only in one. And Gene Hackman and not Rene Russo. Who's the other actress?
I remember this one, a beginning part, because he was like...
The Firm.
Yeah, The Firm. Yes. And he went to his house, and they started having to clean out the house. And,
yes. So yeah. Like The Firm, you know, that's like Colleen's type of movie.
Does she like British?
The Girl on the Train.
Intrigue stuff? No. She doesn't like the foreign stuff, huh?
Well, she just likes something that's, you know.
Well, a lot of great intrigue, British intrigue stuff. You know, Sherlock Holmes, the remakes and everything.
If I said, hey, let's watch a Sherlock Holmes. Now, I know there's been a Dick Cumberbatch that's been remade and stuff like that, but we haven't gotten into that. You know what we've been watching? We've seen only two episodes, and I know there's more. There's a show called The Sinner on FX, I think. We've watched it on demand a couple times. It stars Jessica Biel, who, I don't know if you know who that is. She's Justin Timberlake's wife, beautiful actress who was on, I think, became famous on Seventh Heaven. Is that possible? So she's in the show. Thank you, Jess. Jess says yes, Seventh Heaven. Jessica Biel's in the show that starts out about a kind of distraught mom with a young kid and a husband and kind of a rough family life in that they live next door to her in-laws who are way smothering. And it seems like, you know, just a general whatever. And then they're at the beach and she kills a guy. In broad daylight.
Nice.
Like, stabs him to death.
Hello.
And now she's... Oh, and you know who else is in it? Is Bill Pullman as a detective. And so it's very interesting so far as why did she do this? Why did she snap? Yeah. Things like that. So that's been a pretty good show. Okay. And just this week, Manhunt Unabomber wrapped up. I've told you about this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Rod, you got to watch that. That was the best thing I saw this summer.
Time for...
It's only 8 hours. Oh. It's only 8 episodes.
Well, it's only 8 hours.
Well, you know, when you talk about binge watching and stuff, in a couple of weeks you get an hour here or there.
Right.
It was so fast. Now, you must have been reporting news when 94, 95, and when the Unabomber really
94,
became
95,
famous.
95, I was going them? Back to school. Yeah, I just, 95 to 96 would have been my first teaching job at Downers North.
Do you remember very well when...
I followed
they
it.
Arrested Kaczynski?
Yeah,
or
I followed
even the many
it.
Years before when there was the Unabomber case, you know, that they were searching for this person. And
well, we were all aware of the that event.
I mean, I remember the arrest.
Leading up to it and everything, sure.
But I don't remember a lot of the coverage because, you know,
there was
arrested.
There was coverage ahead of time because
there
of the manifestos and stuff and, you know, things.
Sure. But, you know, he had been bombing since like 76.
Right. Well, but it didn't start coming out until the early 90s when it really started making the news. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it would be with the manifesto.
Yeah. So that's when I became aware of it.
I can't remember if I told you this. I know I've talked about this recently, but it's so fascinating the way that they catch him. Now, everybody knows that his brother turned him in, right?
Mm.
But the way they figure out we're on to who this could be. So they didn't know the name Ted Kaczynski until his brother reached out to the FBI after the manifesto was published. David's brother's wife read the manifesto and said to her husband, I think this is your brother.
Ooh.
And he read it and said, there's no way. I know it couldn't be him. Mm-hmm. Blah, 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 blah. So they, and she wanted to contact them, and he was very reluctant because he hadn't been in touch with David. David didn't like, or Ted didn't like David's wife. So they had a falling out, mm-hmm. and he was reluctant to go to the police because if it's not him, then he, or, you know, he just didn't want to bring that upon his brother and to falsely accuse him. And he worried about where this would go. So they went to a lawyer who said he would send, what did he send them? I think he sent them just some information or maybe a letter David had written. I can't remember what exactly it was, but he sent them some information that the FBI dismissed, mm-hmm. at least according to this movie, which tried very hard to stick close to the facts, I know. So the FBI is dismissing it until it gets into the hands of this forensics guy who's doing forensic linguistics. And they had a whole team because they'd been searching for this guy for 15 years.
Yeah.
And they had it all wrong who they were looking for. Mm. Age, intellect, everything was wrong. And this guy, this FBI guy, and it's a brand new thing, this forensic linguistics at the time, you know, while the manifesto is very famous, he had been writing letters for years and sending them to newspapers and things like that. So
they've been leaving clues, connections of some kind.
Well, they'd had a lot of his writings.
Mm-hmm.
And so the linguistics team was going over, what does he write? How does he write it? Can we glean any clues to who he is based on what he wrote?
Right.
And so they figured out that he was actually, the FBI had his profile as not smart and lacking in education.
Mm-hmm.
But the linguistics team figured out he was actually very smart. And they realized that he must have gotten a PhD within a certain set of years. Maybe that part was until after the manifesto. I can't remember if it was earlier. Because of the way he laid out something he had written, they realized that that was the exact standard for writing PhD theses between these certain years.
Oh,
so they knew, okay, he got a PhD between like 69 and 72 or something along those mm-hmm. lines. And then they kept catching like misspellings or differences in spellings within his writings. So like
that were comparable across the writings.
Yeah. So like there'd be a word that we would normally write with two L's that he only wrote with one
mm-hmm.
and a bunch of different words like that. And so they're trying to figure out, they get all the style books, AP style, everything, trying to figure out why would he be taught to write it this way?
Mm-hmm.
They find out that it was Colonel McCormick's style book for the Chicago Tribune.
Mm.
So they knew that between this certain amount of years, he grew up reading the Chicago Tribune.
Oh.
And so that's how they traced him back to Chicago.
Interesting.
And that's how they started putting. And so then when Kaczynski's brother came forward, they start piecing together all these things
mm-hmm.
and figure out that this probably is our guy. And they're having trouble getting the warrant. And I don't know if they exaggerated this part or not, but they got to get a warrant. They know where he's at. And they're going to go and they're keeping an eye on him
mm-hmm.
and he hadn't left his cabin in a while and they need a warrant to go get him. But all they have, which had never really been done before, all they have is to go say, hey, we think this guy writes like this guy. We need to go arrest him. So
right.
they're struggling to get the warrant. And the guy that needs to sign the warrant and to take it to a judge is saying, you don't have enough here. You don't have enough here. And so what ends up being their smoking gun is, I believe in the manifesto, he wrote, eat your cake and have it too. And of course, we all know the phrase as have your cake and eat it too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that was in the manifesto, I believe. And they had another writing from Ted. Like, so the brother had given them like boxes and boxes of letters that Ted had written with him over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of them, Ted had written, have your cake and eat it too.
Mm.
And so the guy who's supposed to sign the warrant is like, that is very different. And it's interesting that he's got that wrong. And the FBI goes, no, he's got it right. It got changed over the years. We all say it wrong. The phrase is, have your cake and eat it too, or eat your cake and have it too. And, you know, it makes sense that this guy's this smart that he's saying it the correct way.
Right.
And so that's why the guy ends up signing the warrant and they go after him. But then it's all about, too, that the FBI really did not want a trial. They don't want the public spectacle of him telling the world all these things. And so there's a lot of pressure that they feel to try to get him to accept a plea. And how that ends up coming about is fascinating. It's good to the last drop.
Right.
Manhunt Unabomber on the Discovery Channel.
Well, we finally subscribed to our first cable channel.
You got one.
I was forced to by Bridget.
It's the Mr. T starter kit. What did you get?
We got Stars.
Why Stars?
Because Outlander is on it. And now, she is hooked on Outlander, and the third season just started.
So I've only seen like a 2 seconds of ads for it on Xfinity right now. When you go to the on-demand, they're always playing something about a show coming up, and they're doing Outlander. And to me, as I see it for 2 seconds, I'm like, what is this Game of Thrones ripoff?
No, it's not a Game of Thrones.
But it looks like it's just some sort of medieval.
She travels between centuries. She time travels, and she ends up in the past. From what I understand, I haven't watched it, so nobody Outlander fans, please don't beat me up. But she ends up helping during a war, and she's a nurse, so she goes back into the past and starts practicing nursing using 20th century, 21st century techniques that, of course, nobody knows about back then. But she starts helping, like, her great-grandfather or somebody. I'm going to get it messed up. But then she's got marital issues in the future. And then she keeps disappearing.
Ugh.
And things keep happening to her life in the past and in the future. And it's a portal up on a hill somewhere that she did. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And then at the end of one season, all of a sudden she finds herself thrown through the portal without her doing. And she's in the present. And I hate to say it's a chick flick, but it's all about love and that kind of stuff. And
I'm going to say it sounds a little complicated, Raj.
Well, I guess. I don't know. It's, again, based on a series of books, I think. And Bridget loves it. Her sister loves it. And they watch it. They binged watch it. Watched it 2 times ago when we were out in Massachusetts. And they binged watched it, unbeknownst to me.
Well, what's important is that you made your wife happy.
Yes. So she says, can we get Stars? I go, yeah, I think we can get Stars. Get it.
Do it.
She says, it's $9 a month. Get it. Oh, I go, okay.
$9 a month for one channel.
For one channel, for one show.
Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Orion Samuelson coming up at 5 o'clock with the morning show, and then you got your Lou Manfredini and everything else that we cover all day long here on 720 WGN. John Williams will actually be on this morning because the Wildcats don't play till tonight. Right, Raj?
That is correct, sir. In fact, Lou is out with the Blackhawks this morning.
Oh, is he really?
And so will John. They're going to both do their shows from the United Center.
What's going on this early in the morning at the United Center?
I think it's I don't know if they're going to start playing, but it's a scrimmage, I think, this morning.
Okay.
So they're
John and Lou aren't taking part, right? Because I don't think that will go well.
Well, you never know. Mm. You know,
I know it won't go well. That part I do know.
Someone might kidnap him and strap some skates on him and throw him out on the ice. Who knows? See him slipping and sliding all over the place?
That could happen. Tom Rivers from ABC News will hopefully be joining us in just a moment. He's supposed to be calling in from London. Joining us on the phone right now from London is Tom Rivers from ABC News. Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Matt. Yeah, we're doing okay. The weekend has arrived here in London. People are trying to get back to normal. And part of that process is the subway system. And Parsons Green, the station where this incident happened yesterday, is open. That particular line of the district line is open for business. So people slowly trying to get back to normal under the background of a huge manhunt going on here, orchestrated and led by the people over at Scotland Yard. They are in the lead on this thing, and we'll see what shakes out maybe later on today.
So at least 29 people injured, no fatalities as of the moment. I read that the bomb only partially exploded, and that probably saved us from a much worse incident.
Exactly. If you've seen the pictures, you're looking at a 5-gallon bucket, a pail, and that was full of the charge that did not go up. Only thing that went up, part of the detonator went up, but it did not ignite the charge. So yes, people are counting their lucky stars. For instance, it would have been packed with things more than likely with shrapnel. None of that moved out of the bucket. So that's good, and people want to get on with their lives. But as I say, Scotland Yard has got a real task on their hands right now. They're going through things like closed-circuit television, all of the stations in that area, also the cameras on the subway train, trying to determine who it is, where they might be living, and to get to the bottom of this as quickly as possible.
Tom, it's been almost 20 years since I've been on the tube in London, so I don't know what things are like there, but what are the type of security measures they, you know, the attacks are getting more and more crude, right? There's a lot of attacks mm-hmm. where cars are just running people down, things like that. They can't orchestrate things as big, so they're finding ways that they can get away with things. And a packed subway train is a terrifying place to have something explode. Is there a lot of security already in place when people are getting on the subway? I think of the rail systems here in Chicago and New York as things that are somewhat autonomous, right? We don't have a lot of places we have to necessarily go through things or check in with people. We have our fare cards. We go through the turnstiles. We get in. And there's not a lot to prevent us from bringing whatever we want in the system. What's it like in London?
Yeah, Matt, it's the same, and things really haven't changed a whole lot in 20 years, other than they probably upgraded some of the carriages and some of the lines. Some of the cars you were in 20 years ago are still in operation here. As far as security, you see pockets of armed police. There's not enough police to put at every single station.
Sure.
Just won't work. So you see, you might, on your station, on Monday, you'll say, wow, I went to the station and there was half a dozen police with you know, automatic weapons and flak jackets, the whole nine yards. You might not see them at your station, who knows, for another month or 6 weeks. They move them around because that is all they can do at this stage. There's not the resources. There's not the manpower. But it is being beefed up. We're at the critical, the highest threat level here in London. Can't go any higher. And what does that mean? By definition, it means another attack is imminent. That's kind of chilling. And we've got the military roped in to do some of the more mundane patrolling duties here so the police can be freed up to do more of the investigation work. So that's where we stand. We're at a similar place. Think back 4 months ago, Manchester, with the bombing up there, where the military was called in just for a couple of days. But again, we've seen this before. We've been down this road before.
Well, that's the thing that's kind of crazy. This is the fifth terrorist attack this year. And I reached out yesterday to one of my friends who works for the BBC. And she said, yeah, you know, we're just so happy nobody was hurt. I'm off to Scotland for the weekend. And I'm wondering, you know, the British are famous for their demeanor. But are the British people getting used to the idea that this is something we live with now?
You know, it's a funny thing, and it's not because a government official says you must go on with your life, you must be vigilant. People do that on their own regardless of what talking politician is on television saying that. Why? Out of necessity. People have to go from A to B to go to work Monday. Will they show up? Will they be a bit nervous on Monday? They sure will. Thinking back 12 years ago to the attacks, the big attacks here in London on three subway cars and a bus. The day after, it was kind of a weird experience getting back on the subway. The next day, not so bad. By the end of the week, you're back to normal saying, you know, I got to get some groceries on the way home. I'm going to stop off at this pub, whatever. You get back to real normal real quick, regardless of what has gone down incident-wise. And you look at the numbers. something like 3 million people get on the subway each and every day here in London. Like the tide coming in, and then in the afternoon, they all go home. And you go by the numbers, 29 people were injured. Good thing it was only minor injuries, but 29 people got injured. 3 million people went from A to B without any problems. The people here kind of get that.
It's fascinating to think about just, you know, learning to deal with that. And let me ask about, so here in America, especially in the last few years, here at Wrigley Field in Chicago now, you go through pretty heavy metal detectors before you get into the stadium. And that's becoming commonplace almost anywhere you go where 20,000 people or more will gather. Subway system is much different because there aren't 20,000 people all in the same place. But as you said, there's 3 million people passing through it. Has there been any talk, or can you foresee, I know this is very speculative that I'm asking you to take part in here, but is there a way to make a transit system more safe by doing something like that? Or is it just there's no way to hire enough people to monitor to even tackle that?
You know, that's a great question. As you said, over the past year, we've had a number of attacks, and it's almost like rent an expert. They roll them out. They put them on TV. And some people have come forward and said, yeah, we should have like airport scanners at every one of the hundreds of subway stations. This town would grind to a halt.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. You're right. At the major stadiums, do we have increased security? You bet. And it's doable because you got a lot of people congregated in one space, and it will work. On a very large, it's the largest subway system in the world. It's the oldest as well.
Yeah.
And you cannot do that. So what do you have to do? You have to say, look, you guys in intelligence, you gotta double up and be proactive. The words of the president. You got to get there before there's a problem, because otherwise you're playing catch-up ball. You're really behind the curve, and you're in a situation like we are right here, right now in London, trying to figure out who did this.
Well, let's talk about, as long as you brought it up, Donald Trump tweeted about a loser terrorist, and that he said, quote, "These are sick and demented people who are in the sights of Scotland Yard. Must be proactive." I understand the reaction on the other side of the pond hasn't been real favorable to him speaking out like that.
Yeah, well, you got to understand, we don't have all the background to this. Was this based upon intelligence that the president had, any kind of said this or tweeted this, or was it just conjecture on his part? If you go back, think of the past 2 years, were some of the bombers in Nice, Berlin, Brussels, Paris, Manchester, London, were some of them on the radar? You bet. A lot of them were. And for whatever reason, they were dropped off. They had to look at other individuals. And that's a real important question. When and how do you determine when someone should come off the list? That has not been clarified. And as far as the record of people that authorities on the continent and here in Britain have looked at in the past and said, well, I don't think this guy's going to do anything, they're not shooting really good as far as a batting average right now. And that's a very, very – it's something a lot of people don't want to hear, certainly in the British government, but it's something that's staring you right in the eye.
Yeah, no kidding. And so we don't know if the president had some sort of intelligence that he was tweeting about, but if he did – and if that's intelligence that all of our allies kind of share with each other to help in the fight on terror, how much does that piss off people in Scotland Yard and Theresa May that here we're sharing this intelligence and our president is using it to call out, you know, to say something like that? That's a concern I know over here in the past with things he's shared, is that people are going to become less likely to share things with us if they keep getting frustrated by it.
Exactly. It oftentimes in these investigations, the police on the ground want to keep those things that are important to them close to their vest until they reach a point where they get a dead end. Then they might say, let's release some of this information out to the public and see if we can stir up some more leads. And that's kind of the mentality. It's not like for the sake of it, holding back information from the public here.
Yeah.
It's like, let's roll it out. We control, in essence, the authorities want to control the information flow, saying, you know, we think we know who this guy is. We're not sure of his name. And they'll investigate. They may come up to a blank, at which point they might put the picture out on the internet and say, is anybody, and somebody will pop up and say, yeah, I know who that guy is. He lives around the corner from me, whatever. So they want to control the information. They don't want outside, in this case, potentially the president, controlling the information flow. We saw the same thing in Manchester with the leaked release of the bomb, the aftermath of the suicide bomber up there. It was unique because the detonator was very, very elaborate, and authorities wanted to keep that particular aspect out of the public domain because that was an important part that differentiated that attack from other attacks. So they want to control the info, and they kind of get angry when other people jump ahead of them outside of the country.
I only have a minute left with you, Tom, so I want to ask you a fun question just for a moment of levity. The NFL season has started, and we keep playing a game or two over there every year to try to build up an international fan base. Do you hear anything about the NFL when you're in London?
Of course. I've covered with the exception of one game. I've covered all of them. So this year, Matt, we got four games. We got two at Wembley. Two at Twickenham. Twickenham is the national rugby stadium.
Okay.
Next year, we got a new stadium for one of the top-flight soccer teams here, Tottenham Hotspur. They're going to have some NFL games, too. So potentially, they haven't firmed it up yet, but we could be looking at more than four. Who knows? We could be looking at six games next year.
Well,
so it's great, Matt. I can sit in one place, and the NFL comes to me. I'm quite happy being a Vikings fan.
Sure.
Kick you off.
Well, no, I'm fine with it. You know, the Bears need to be good before we get ticked off at other teams. So we've got a couple of years before we're real concerned about rivalries again, Tom. But, you know, there was an interesting article in the last week or two about the Jacksonville Jaguars, who play a game over there every year. And because it sells out and because they get to treat it as a home game and keep the bulk of the revenue, it's 20% of their revenue every year is playing that one game over there. And there's talk about maybe they would stay and do two games 2 weeks in a row. And that's certainly a possibility as NFL continues to expand the games. But so you feel like there is a groundswell that it is getting support, that, you know, soccer tries to catch on here. And I'm seeing more and more Premier League soccer, because I think NBCSN carries it here now. So we are seeing it more and more. But do you think the NFL is making real headway into, are there fans, are there people getting excited about it, or is it American football?
I tell you, Matt, I remember about 30 years ago, I covered a Bears and a Vikings game in Gothenburg, Sweden. And I talked to the GM of the Vikings at the time and says, "Why are you guys over here?" And he says, "We're selling shirts." And that's the name of the game. If they can make money out of this, they're going to continue doing it.
Sure.
And guess what? Every game at Wembley, every game at Twickenham is sold out. You can't sell one more seat there. And when you go to the games here, Matt, you know, say the Bears come next year, you're going to have some Bears jerseys, but you're going to have every jersey from every other team there, sort of like their Super Bowl when the fans get together here. And it's a lot of fun. They make money. And you're right. Jacksonville is kind of in this weird orbit of their own. They're kind of like, if you will, London's adopted NFL team. So who knows down the road if they're going to have a team over here? And it's always talked about. And it won't happen tomorrow. But if it happens, it might happen in 10 years. That might be a team that might be prone to coming over this way. We'd have to wait and see.
I just can't imagine it truly actually happening other than like two games at most a year until we get supersonic travel back, until we get another, you know, until we bring that mode of travel back and the speed. I just can't imagine these teams being willing to take six to 8 hour flights.
We're looking at this as opposed to, you know, going back and forth each week. You could, as you say, play two or three games here in London. And then you might have, like, let's pull it out of the air. Let's have, like, a mini hub for this London team. I don't know. Station maybe in Kansas City. Put them in the middle of the country. And they'll do two or three games in the U.S. And they're all not that far away. And they come back here and do two or three more games. That's not a heavy-duty push, really. That's something that would be doable, as opposed to every week going back and forth. That would kill the interest,
And I guess if you have at least the 1 week off, as they do right now, maybe go back to having 2 weeks off so that there was a little more rest time for those teams because of the jet lag and stuff. That's interesting. If they can truly become international like that, that would be pretty, pretty wild. Tom Rivers from ABC News, thank you so much for getting up with us this morning. We really appreciate it, Tom.
Take care now.
All right. Talk to you soon. Tom Rivers at your ABC News in London. News here in Chicago is next on 720 WGN. Play ball, celebrate the Cubs with team memorabilia, exclusive books, and so much more. Visit ChicagoTribuneStore.com today. The intercom system that lets Roger and I talk to each other between the first and seventh floor seems to not be working. Is there anything you were trying to get a hold of me for, Roger? Are we just making sure the lines of communication are
open? I was just testing it because it was working earlier, and then now it's not. So
could a button be stuck? Because when you're talking to me just now, it like came through my ear. And it normally doesn't. So I wonder if something is like stuck up there that you need to loosen up. Sometimes
let me check it. Let me take the professional technician that I am in my spare time.
He's about to punch something. Well, it sounds like it'll work now.
That should do.
I like it. Yeah. Little oil, some ball bearings. It's all going to work just fine. Don't you worry.
Well, you remember what how they fixed it? No time for sergeants. Right?
This is another Kelly's Heroes. I haven't seen No Time
no,
for
no,
Sergeants.
No. This is Andy from Mayberry. This was a play made into a movie.
Andy Griffith?
Yeah. And he was very good in it. It's cute. It's very funny. He said, my daddy always told me, you spit in the back and slap it on the side. That'll fix anything.
Spit in the back, slap
any outside. Any machine. Just give it a whack.
Well, we've all tried it, right? At some point or another.
I think we
just look at it and say, just hit the damn thing. Maybe it'll start working. All right, 4:32 in the morning. Let's check the headlines now with Roger Badish. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the number. Raj, you mentioned the Cubs play today. They beat the Cardinals yesterday.
That's a lot like about you. What?
John Lackey and Wilson Contreras both get ejected.
Did you see that?
And they don't get ejected on the actual play that they're upset about. They get ejected right afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Should have been a called third strike batter with runners on first and second.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's ball four.
Right.
And then the next batter.
No. It's ball three.
I'm sorry. That's right. It's ball
three. And then the pitcher who was up, who had already walked away thinking himself it was strike three, comes back. The Lackey had already started to go off. Contreras had kind of sat there for a second, not knowing what's going on. Pitcher comes back. He's getting another at-bat. Lackey throws one right down the middle. Pitcher knocks it into
right center field.
Yeah. A run comes in. Lackey runs behind Contreras as the pitcher is supposed to do to back him up.
The play.
But if you watch it for a split second, you think, oh, my God, he's going to attack the umpire.
Yeah.
It really looks that way because he comes barreling behind Contreras. He doesn't trot. He's running lickety-split. And as he's backing up Contreras, he's yelling vehemently at the umpire, who, within a split second of Lackey getting there, he gives him the little thumb. He doesn't do a real exaggerate. Just, hey, you're out of here.
My guess is that the umpire knew he blew this call.
Oh, yeah.
Because Lackey blew up after the original pitch.
Yep.
And he didn't kick him out.
Right.
And Lackey was very exaggerated. So he could have just tossed him right then and there.
Yeah.
But he waits. Now, if you follow me on Twitter, and give me a follow at Matt Bubala on Twitter, Bubala, I just, the video's out there, and so I froze it and took a picture of it.
Ooh.
When the strike zone thing pops up in the right corner. Because as I watched the video, I'm like, yeah, that looks like a strike, but it had a lot of movement on it.
Right.
Contreras.
He didn't sell it.
He did afterwards. You see Contreras catch it and then move his glove back to the zone to frame it, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
He catches it and then reframes it, and it's called a ball. The guy was walking away, right? The guy thought that's a strike. He's walking away, and then he has to come back. And you see that often when somebody thinks they got to walk, but it was actually called a strike, and they have to come back sheepishly.
Yeah.
Here a guy thinks he's called out.
Right. He's
walking
back.
And then he has to come back.
Out.
He's like, oh, I'm still good? Okay, I'll take another crack at this.
And it was the pitcher. Even he knew it was a strike.
So as you look at this freeze frame I put up on Twitter, it shows the dot from where the strike was.
That was pitch number five.
Oh, my God. It's right
there.
It's in the lower half of the strike zone, but it's in the middle of the plate. And that's their data from cameras and sensors. That's not just somebody going, yeah, I was right there. That's official Major League Baseball data.
Exactly.
And that is really, and I do not like John Lackey. I do not like John Lackey. He's such a spaz, such a crab all the time. Not good to his teammates, I don't think. But he had a right to be not happy about that one. That's for sure.
And then Contreras, after Lackey got tossed and the play was over, Contreras
really
just exploded. Oh, my God. And for a second, I thought he was going to throw his mask at the umpire.
Phil Rogers, the great baseball writer who used to write for the Tribune and now writes for MLB.com, he tweeted earlier today, I hadn't seen what was going on, but I'm looking at my Twitter feed, and he says, Javi Baez just saved Contreras from a long suspension.
Oh, yeah.
And when you see it, you do, he is hot.
They couldn't pull him away. And he kept trying to circle around and circle around, and oh my God, I saw the whole thing. I'm sitting at home watching the thing. I could not believe it.
Yeah, that was
it. Just
and the Cubs rebound; they don't fall apart, which is nice, and they go on and win again.
Yeah, because they were losing at that time. Yeah. It was 2-1.
And it was 1-1.
Right, and the run scored and made it 2-1, and then the Cubs back and kicked their butt.
Yeah. So, Cubs are on a roll. Hopefully they keep it going.
Yeah.
More to come. 720 WGN. Texts that are coming in about my Donald Trump comments, because I get yelled at every week by certain texters if I bring up Donald Trump, if I say anything negative about our president. 708 writes, I commented about you making Trump comments last week. You said you weren't pandering, but will say what's on your mind. But yet again, you're trying to stir up anti-Trump emotions again. London just got attacked again, and for no logical reason, you ask if they're angry at what Trump said. Explain why the English people would give a damn about what he says right now. Pander much? Okay. It would be pandering if I had an opinion and I didn't say it, because I just want to pander to everybody to make them happy that I don't complain about things. There are a lot of stories out about Theresa May, who said it's never helpful to speculate on what is an ongoing investigation. It is legitimate because they are unhappy about it. These are allies of ours that we need in the war on terror and such things. And whenever we do things that annoy them by shooting off our mouths or butting ourselves into an investigation or into their issues, if London had made a bunch of comments about what we are doing wrong and how we should have known this was coming after 9/11, we would have been very annoyed with them. You don't do that to your allies. And we don't know that he wasn't revealing information. He might have been. 773 says the president is making a point that this kind of terrorist will probably come to the United States if we don't build a wall and put more restrictions on certain Islamic countries. Okay. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you for a few more minutes here before the morning show with Orion Samuelson. Coming up in just a few, Selena Gomez surprisingly announced that she had a kidney transplant this summer. Or just a few days ago, was the center of attention after she took to Instagram to disclose that she had a kidney transplant due to lupus complications earlier this summer, but she appeared to be on the mend already as she was spotted on Thursday in New York on the set of her upcoming movie with Woody Allen. So I think she just released on, she wrote on her, let's see, in 2016 she canceled part of her tour due to lupus. She shared a photo on Instagram on September 14th, wrote, I'm very aware some of my fans had noticed I was laying low for part of the summer and questioning why I wasn't promoting my new music, which I was extremely proud of. So I found out I needed to get a kidney transplant due to my lupus and was recovering. It was what I needed to do for my overall health. I honestly look forward to sharing with you soon my journey through these past several months, as I have always wanted to do with you. Until then, I want to publicly thank my family and incredible team of doctors for everything they have done for me prior to and post-surgery. And finally, there aren't words to describe how I can possibly thank my beautiful friend, Francia Riza. She gave me the ultimate gift and sacrifice by donating her kidney to me. I am incredibly blessed. I love you so much, sis. Lupus continues to be a very misunderstood, but progress is being made. For more information regarding lupus, please go to the Lupus Research Alliance website, lupusresearch.org. So, good for Selena that she is getting through that, and congratulations to her on being able to have a moment of privacy over the summer and not have TMZ banging down her door and everybody reporting on it. It still can be done in this day and age. Roger, you're telling me off the air a second ago that you believe they're announcing an arrest was made in London?
Yeah, BBC is reporting an 18-year-old man was arrested by Kent police in Dover in connection with the bombing in London on Friday. Again, that's all we're hearing from the police and from the BBC. I'm sure further details will come out as the morning progresses. But that has just broken. So
they said in connection with,
we don't know if he's the guy, if he's
part of a group.
There may be more. The investigation's continuing. They're still looking. In fact, I got a report coming up at 5 o'clock from BBC, or not from Sky News reporter about how the investigation is proceeding.
And as Tom Rivers was just telling us from ABC News a little while ago, the threat level is at the highest, which means they think that another attack is imminent. So we'll find out more as the day progresses about this arrest. But hopefully it's not just what happened, but preventing what could happen as well.
Yeah.
More to come in Rogers Newscast at the top of the hour. Matt Bubala with you here for just another second on 720 WGN. Roger, I will be back next weekend. Hoping Justice is going to be looking. I want to talk a little bit more about that, what was an apparent sort of attack on diplomats maybe in Cuba with some sort of sonic frequency. Have you been keeping up with that story at all this week, Roger?
No, I haven't. I'm aware of the story. I haven't read it in depth, and I will do my homework.
We won't necessarily find out about the diplomats, but I want to find out about that as a weapon and research that's done in that and how that's used. Is that a real thing, or could this be explained away as something that just happened? But as the story goes on, it becomes more and more fascinating.
Yeah.
So we'll try to do a little bit of that next week on the show. Also, there was a story this week we didn't get to about somebody who's a free runner. Overseas, or parkour, you know, where people run around and jump from things to things. So it was a guy who did this and really dedicated his life to it, and he died because he climbed between a subway train and stuck his head up and got hit by something.
Mm.
And his mom gave a very interesting eulogy where she wanted to sing the praises of his lifestyle, and it was his passion, and he wanted to run free and do all these things. And I just thought it was so interesting to hear because her son died because of the kind of reckless nature of what he was doing. But she, it's just really interesting. We'll play some audio from that next week and talk about it as well. But coming up next, it's time to say hello and good morning to Mr. Orion Samuelson.